you'll notice that there are two crucial questions. One concerns the presence of Christ in the sufferer. The other concerns the question of whether grace is communicated in the sufferer. This should properly go at the end of the section on the Lord's Supper in your notebook. It asks, is Christ present in the sufferer? And then you see the four basic views. If so, in what sense is he present? And you see that you run from transubstantiation, consubstantiation, to a, both of which involve Christ being physically present, to this idea of spiritual presence in Calvin's view. Luther insisted that the deity of Christ in terms of omnipresence, at least, was communicated to the body and blood of Christ, so that Christ's body and blood could be everywhere in the supper, physically everywhere. But of course, Luther was not interested in proving that Christ's body and blood was everywhere, but specifically in the supper, in those places where the supper was being celebrated. Calvin insisted that Christ was physically present in heaven and that he would remain there until his coming, but that he is spiritually present in the supper to those who receive the supper with faith. The question of grace being communicated through the supper, you notice Zwingli says no. The reason those blocks are shaded out is because if you say no, obviously then the other blocks don't obtain. If grace is communicated through the supper, and you notice all three of the other views say yes, the question is what's the nature of the grace? And there they're fairly similar. The Calvin's view adds assurance. And then the question of how the grace is received, that's where they differ considerably. In the Roman Catholic view, grace is received by doing the thing, by participating, by act of acting, by actually doing what is involved in the supper, that is, by giving and receiving of the element with the words of institution. And in Luther's view, you recall that in the Lutheran view, faith comes by hearing and hearing by the word, taking that scripture to mean that whenever the word is preached or read, but especially preached, that if an obstacle is not interposed, faith is produced in the reader or hearer, particularly the hearer. And so it turns out to be a kind of a passive faith, that is, it's produced as you listen to the words of institution and receive spiritual nourishment, that is, this grace. In Calvin's view, there has to be active faith. There has to be an exercise of faith. It doesn't come ex opere operato by doing it. It doesn't come by passively listening to the words of institution and letting them produce faith in you. It comes by active faith in the spiritual significance and in the promise which God attaches to this ordinance. The promise, of course, being that which Jesus enunciated when he spoke of the new covenant, which is given for the remission of sins, and this being symbolic, being the one of the two ordinances of that new covenant, particularly emphasizing forgiveness of sins. And so this requires understanding. That is, faith here requires understanding if one is to exercise it actively. Of course, see, these don't apply in the Zwinglian view because no grace is communicated through the sufferer. However, a little footnote. When we say there's no grace communicated through the sufferer in the Zwinglian view, you understand it depends on how you define grace. For example, if you define grace as spiritual blessing, then a number of those who espouse the Zwinglian view believe that there's spiritual blessing in the sufferer. And Zwingli himself got pretty close to the idea of assurance in terms of confirmation, which is another way almost of saying assurance. I mean, they're not just pledges and badges in Zwingli. There's also the idea of assurance, but not in that term. See, there's a problem between the reformers as far as using the same concepts and same terms. But, well, anyway. Luther hammered, this is my body. And Calvin said, but Christ's body is in heaven. And Luther said, by the power of God, he can do this. And of course, it's hard to argue with the power of God. You know, it's like saying, don't you think the Holy Spirit can do this? You know, and you're hung whatever way you answer that question. So in some cases, I think if, as you read into Zwingli, if you look at his work on the Lord's Supper, you might get the impression that maybe this is too simplistic, and I would agree with you, but it's a simple chart, so don't try to make it walk too hard. I mean, it's a simple chart, and I've already now put the qualifier in, and I've put the footnote in. I haven't put it in the chart because that would make the chart very complicated. And you see, in some of the blocks, I had a little problem getting it all in anyway. So, leave it at that. Now, today, questions on that? Questions, Michael and then Ray.
In Calvin's view,
yes.
Is spiritually present in the sacral vision in the supper. What is it by in?
In the process of distribution, the process of the words of institution, the distribution of the elements, and the reception of the elements, he's present to those who by faith recognize and understand the symbolism of the elements and draw near to him in the supper so that he might draw near to them. It's not essentially different, Michael, as I understand it, from drawing near in prayer and Christ drawing near to you in prayer. Now, that's not everybody would call that spiritually present. They might say it, I don't know if they say it this way. They have a subjective experience or a subjective apprehension of Christ as they draw near to him. A conscious awareness of Christ as being present with him and he with them. That idea. And so in the Calvinistic view, there's a greater stress on being with the Lord alone, trying to not shut out the horizontal communion of believers, but to shut out all distractions, all distracting thoughts, and communing with Christ in the supper. So there's that idea. And it's admittedly subjective, but in this case, faith is seen to rise up and draw near to Christ, and he then to the recipient who exercises faith. It's that idea.
So, in doesn't have any kind of connotation with
No. There's, There's no localized presence in the inn. That's, in fact, what they objected to in the other views, localized presence. And Ray?
In Calvin's view, Christ is spiritually present in the supper to those who receive it with faith. Does that imply that those who do not receive it in faith, does that imply that Christ is not spiritually present in it?
That's what it implies.
Okay, if that is true, how do we account for the fact that people died and some were ill, and it seems that this same thing, I could approach the Bible and receive Christ spiritually through faith. I don't see any need for this physical sign. It seems as though if it's just a physical sign in which we subjectively express faith, then it's the same as, it's not much better than the Old Testament ordinances or laws that were given to help us and aid our faith. It doesn't seem to me to be any better. And again, if that's the way God wanted that we have a physical sign like that, that's fine. But in the light of the fact people died and were sick and ill, I don't see people dying because they read their Bible with lack of faith. So it can't be exactly the same thing.
You've got a point. Why particularly the abuse of this ordinance has attached to it sickness and death is an interesting question. I don't know why it would be attached to this and not to baptism, for example. Or why it would be attached to this and not to prayer or the word, as you mentioned. If, as Hodge, for instance, says, means of grace are the word, sacraments, and prayer, and then builds on that. A special meaning apparently is attached to this that we don't see any evidence of attachment to the other aspects of means of grace. So you could then imply certain things from that and say, well, that implies that such and such and such. But Calvin's view does not do that.
Okay, maybe there's another view that isn't on the chart that is not.
That's very possible. Yes. Yes. Yeah, there's only four views. Yeah. Any other questions? All right. Let's go on. Let's go on to page 188. Here we move from pneumatology, person and work of the Holy Spirit, through ecclesiology, the church and its ordinances, to eschatology. First, the states of persons after death, and under that, first, death. What is death? What is death? It's a very sobering question. It has exercised many, many, many people over the centuries. The great mystery of death. What does it mean to die? What is it like to experience death? And what do we know about it? Well, there are some scriptures here that speak of death. You've read these scriptures, so I will not read them again. I'd like to highlight the development of the doctrine on page 189 and 190. Death, first of all, is the cessation. Cessation is a perfectly good English word. It's not a theological word. So we're not using theological jargon here. It's a good English word. It simply means stopping or ceasing, the cessation. Think of ceasing. You say, why don't you say ceasing? Well, cessation it works better. It's smoother here, stylistically. And then here's a definition of physical death, which it would be very good to learn. Physical death is the cessation of physical life. That's obvious. The cessation of physical activity and processes in the body. This includes cessation of movement. That's the first thing we look for, movement. Person's lying there absolutely still, not moving a muscle. Secondly, cessation of respiration. That's again what we look for. Is he breathing? Is there any They used to take little mirrors and hold it up in front of people's mouths to see, or nostrils, to see if there was any vapor of blood circulation. So you look for the pulse, you look for the heartbeat. You put your ear down maybe, or what, or put a stethoscope there. You look for a heartbeat. Sometimes you can't get any. Metabolism, that you can't very well detect without doing some expensive tests. And brainwave activity as traced by an electroencephalogram. Now, electroencephalograph measures the activity of the brain. It's a complicated machine, but it's fairly simple to read as far as the gross reading of it. The question of whether the needle is going up and down, indicating that you're thinking, that there's, or even not thinking, just brainwave activity, since whatever you do, including breathing, respiration, all that, has something to do with the brain. They look for activity there. I remember I was having an EEG one time, and the technician said, "Mr. Dunsweiler, you're falling asleep." So, I mean, they could tell by looking at the brainwave activity I was falling asleep. So I was too relaxed. Well, anyway, this cessation of vital processes results in physical decomposition and decay of the body. Some of the cells begin to die very quickly. Some cells continue to function for a time afterward. It's interesting. I understand that, like hair and nails sometimes continue to grow. That's very interesting. Medically, death is defined in three ways. First, the absence of clinically detectable vital signs. That's what we're looking for prior to this, except for the EEG. Second, the absence of brainwave activity. There's where the EEG comes in. And third, the irreversible loss of vital functions. That is the setting in of rigor mortis, the stiffness of death, the stiffness of death. The current definition of legal death, that is at least in the state of Pennsylvania, is the absence for either 24 or 48 hours of any brainwave activity. Here's a person who looks as though he or she is clinically dead. They attach them to an EEG machine and they look for brainwaves. And they run the machine for a while and then they stop it, and then 24 hours later they put the person on the machine again. And if they get two separate readings of no brainwave activity, they pronounce the person legally dead. That's the current definition in Pennsylvania of legal death. The third sense, that is the irreversible loss of vital functions, that's the one being used here. The onset of rigor mortis. That's really dead. That's really dead. So that first paragraph, physical death is, that paragraph would be very good to learn. The whole paragraph. Second, page 190, spiritual death, by way of comparison, because now we've got to try to get a handle on this, is the cessation of spiritual life, the cessation of godly activity in the soul's spirit. This includes cessation of vital relationship to God, cessation of activity characterized by holiness and righteousness. Spiritual death does not mean the cessation of all activity in the soul's spirit, for the spiritually dead soul's spirit is involved in ungodly activity and is active in trespasses and sins. So there's a sense in which spiritual death is unlike physical death, although it builds off it in terms of figure. We say a person's spiritually dead. We're building off physical death. We're using spiritually dead in a figurative sense. But there are some ways in which spiritual death is unlike physical death. Because, see, in physical death, there's no movement. There's no movement. There's no activity. In spiritual death, there's plenty of activity. But it's of the wrong kind. So it doesn't quite carry over. Physical death, secondly, is the dissolution of the union of the material body and the non-material soul spirit, which is unnatural and abnormal and alien for human beings. I suggest number two, it doesn't necessarily involve a spatial separation. It requires only a dissolution. There's no, that's again, that's not a technical theological word. It's just one of those 50-cent English words. A dissolution, a dissolving. Why don't you say, dissolution of the union. It's a dissolution of the union. But it doesn't necessarily involve a spatial separation. See, the two can remain in the same space while being, as far as the union is concerned, dissolved from one another. And it does involve the passing of the soul spirit from one state or condition or dimension or realm, see, we're reaching for words here, into another. It does involve that. Third, physical death does not mean the cessation of the soul spirit's existence. I got a little carried away here in this paragraph. It does not cease to exist. It's not absorbed into a larger, more ultimate reality. It doesn't fall in a deep unconscious slumber. It doesn't pass into a state of absolute inactivity. It doesn't pass to an astral plane. It does not enter another body in order to begin a new existence. It does not wander about the world making unexpected experiences, frightening bad people, encouraging good persons, throwing dishes or moving furniture, haunting houses and old castles, etc., etc., etc. Rather, the Bible teaches that the soul spirit following physical death continues in a conscious, disembodied existence and a particular place or state or dimension or realm until the resurrection and the judgment. Following physical death, fourthly, human beings continue to exist first in an intermediate state, then in a final or eternal state. For years, I never heard of such a thing as an intermediate state. Never knew it existed. Thought that after physical death, that was it, you know. But between physical death and resurrection and judgment, we have the intermediate state. Then after resurrection and judgment, we have the final state. So if you can think of human beings being embodied during this present existence, then being disembodied during the intermediate state, then being re-embodied during the final state, if you can remember those words, that might help as far as an outline of what's going on there. Embodied, disembodied, re-embodied. Now, a whole lot of books have appeared, they haven't stopped appearing, and I haven't bought them all, on the death experience in recent years. Of course, you're all familiar with Elizabeth Kübler-Ross on death and dying and her five stages of the grieving process through the experience of death. She lists first denial, then anger, then bargaining, then depression, and then acceptance. And many people who have worked in the helping professions have found that exposition of the experience of death and the grieving experience connected with death and the experience that loved ones go through when they see a loved one dying, they found that very, very helpful. That is, to actually trace that through. She really had done a great deal of work on this particular area. And so in this book on death and dying, she put a lot of her findings into well-ordered words and helpful concepts. And many, many people in the helping professions use this five-stage concept of death. Very helpful. Very helpful. And then, of course, the sequel to it, Questions and Answers on Death and Dying. And then Moody's Life After Life, perhaps the most familiar of the books on the evidence for life after death, or the what happens in the death experience. Jess Weiss, The Vestibule, Martin Abon, The Evidence for Life After Death, and several other books as well. The material I've excerpted in the next three pages which I trust you've read, concerning a typical experience based on 150 cases, a typical experience of death, and what these people experienced in what are called near-death experiences. That was interesting to me, fascinating, but more interesting was the concept that they came out of these experiences with, the religious concepts of what happens at death and what one is to expect at death and following the tunnel or following going through the vestibule or following entering the door, these religious ideas. For most of them came through with a new model, a new understanding. And I've quoted here on page 192 from Life After Life by Raymond Moody. Top of page 192, through all my research, I've not heard a single reference to a heaven or hell, anything like the customary picture to which we're exposed in this society. And then this paragraph, which I think is very important. Rarely someone in one of my audience has proposed demonic explanations. And then Moody responds to that, and he says, in the light of all the machinations which a hypothetical demon would have to have carried out in order to delude his helpless victim, and to what purpose? He certainly has failed miserably, as far as I can tell, to make persuasive emissaries for his program. And I ask, could Satan's purpose be to convince these persons that the Bible is not true when it speaks of judgment, heaven, hell, and the need of salvation from sin and hell through Christ? Because a number of them came through that experience with that very idea. You don't need to be saved. I mean, saved from what? You know, that idea. The whole conception was changed of what happens. And I ask, would that not be a sufficient reason for the machinations that a demon would have to have carried out in order to delude his helpless victims? I would consider that a pretty good motivation. Then Kübler-Ross and some quotations from her, which you've already read. She believes in a life after death without a shadow of a doubt, but what she believes about that life after death has gradually shifted. And she's gotten herself into the occult, which is very unfortunate because of this work that she did prior to that, which was so highly respected. And so many in the helping profession looked at it and said, that's very helpful. They had courses on it, they had seminars on it, workshops here and there and everywhere, and she was really helping a lot of people. And then she gets into this psychic business and the occult business. And it really hasn't done a lot of good for her reputation professionally. I have, for instance, here's an article from People magazine in October 29, 1979. It's entitled, Sex, Visitors from the Grave, Psychic Healing. Kübler-Ross is a public storm center again. And she really has gotten into the whole question of for instance, in this one, the claim is sex as part of the therapy for people who have particular problems that can be healed by this person, Jay Barham, that has purchased a piece of property next to Kübler-Ross's property in California, and how she has lauded him to the skies, and it's just a mess. The whole thing is a mess. What is claimed, she speaks so... She says, until meeting Barham, she had encountered only one entity. See, he introduces these people who come to these workshops to spirit entities. Except some of these spirit entities want to have sex with the people who are engaged in these workshops. Until meeting Barham, she had encountered only one entity named Willie, but has since met three others, Ienka, Salem, and Mario. And she sometimes plays a tape recording of audiences, two audiences, of a male voice talking and singing, and identifies it as Willie's. She also maintains she lived during the time of Christ as a woman named Isabel and was one of Christ's teachers. Then, in Time magazine, November 12, 1979, there was an article entitled "The Conversion of Kübler-Ross from Thanatology, Study of Death, to Seances and Sex." Several years ago, when the psychiatrist raised eyebrows by concluding that death is not so final after all, when people die, Kübler-Ross declared, they very simply shed their body much as a butterfly comes out of its cocoon. Her growing conviction that the living could communicate with the dead led her to dabble in spiritualism at her retreat north of San Diego. Now, Kübler-Ross, who refers to herself as a, quote, immortal visionary and modern cartographer of the river Styx, the river Styx in mythology was the river you cross to death, and she's a cartographer, a map maker, has apparently lost any remaining credibility with her professional colleagues. The reason? Her close association with Jay Barham, who claims to be a psychic and conducts seances that include sexual intercourse between participants and entities from the spirit world. Barham, 50, is a former sharecropper and an aircraft worker who founded the Church of the Facet of Divinity 4 years ago, only in Southern California. In his first meeting with Kübler-Ross, he introduced her to her own personal entity, Salem. Greatly impressed, she talked her husband into buying 42 acres of land just across a lake from a 9-acre ranch used by Barham and his wife, Martha. Kübler-Ross called her property Shanti Nilaya, home of peace, in Sanskrit, and made it a center for workshops on death and dying. Barham conducts group sessions where, he says, spirit entities materialize by cloning themselves from cells of his body. The entities are unusually interested in sex. Participants in the sessions, many well-educated, if gullible, middle-class professionals, have had occasional doubts about the entities. But most put aside their doubts. "I needed to believe," admitted one woman in the group. "It was a sense of being loved unconditionally." Barham also taught participants that they had all lived during the time of Jesus and had been among his disciples. Says one woman recruited as a channel, "He appealed to my ego and really hooked me." Well, I won't read the whole article. She has really lost a considerable amount of credibility, as the article says, amongst her professional colleagues. Death. Well, there's, again and again, you'll see books, articles, even television presentations on this question of life after life or near-death experiences, that kind of thing. And they're very interesting, but of course we've never had anybody who has actually died in the third sense, that is, begun rigor mortis, who has come back and told us about the death experience. So you've got some problems knowing how to interpret their experiences as they narrate them. They're certainly pronounced clinically dead in many cases, and they experience various things and they tell us about it afterwards, but nobody who has actually died in the third sense has come and told us about that death experience. So that's a bit of a problem. Questions on death? Fred? In Questions and Answers on Death and Dying, Kübler-Ross tells about meeting some Christians in the hospitals where she's gone and where she's spoken. And she feels that the people who are really serious about their religion, those are the people who come through these experiences rather well. She's met some Christians, and she hasn't been really impressed too much with their experience. So that if people were followers of Buddha or some other religious orientation and have been really spiritual people, as she defines it, those people come through rather well. She doesn't say too much about Christians, however. For instance, on page 161 of Questions and Answers, she says, on Sunday I was talking to a returned missionary and mentioned to her that I was going to attend a seminar on death and dying. She immediately asked if you were a Christian. This is a letter. She immediately asked if you, people who were a Christian, and then went on to elaborate and say the only important thing was to know if the patient was ready and knew the Lord. I knew what she believes, Hebler Ross says, but I could only conjure a mental picture of someone running into each patient's room asking if they were ready to die. That's a real caricature, by the way. How do you break through to these deeply religious people to make them see that there are more facets to dying than the one mentioned above? And Keebler Ross says, I do not regard these people as truly religious, because if they were really such good Christians, they would accept every human being as thy neighbor and not judge them as good or bad depending on whether they were Christians or non-Christian. She says, in your work, or the question is asked, in your work with the dying patient, have you noticed a difference between a Christian dying patient and the non-Christian as to how they accept death? We work with many more Christian patients than non-Christians. The significant variable is not what you believe, but how truly and genuinely you believe. People who believed in reincarnation or people from Eastern cultures and religions have often accepted death with unbelievable peace and equanimity, even at a young age, whereas many of our Christian patients have had difficulties in their acceptance of death. Only the few true, genuine religious people have accepted death with great peace and equanimity. It's interesting what she says, not what you believe, but how truly and genuinely you believe. Whatever it is you believe. Well, other questions on this area. It's fairly straightforward, although it is a tremendous mystery and a great many things could be said about it and perhaps should be said. The nature of the intermediate states. What is meant by the intermediate state? The state or condition of human beings from the moment of their physical death until their resurrection and judgment. And I've divided that into the intermediate state of the unrighteous and the intermediate state of the righteous. Again, you've read these materials. Sha'ol, Hades. These are the operative words in regard to the intermediate state of the unrighteous. Sha'ol. Again, appears to have three basic meanings. The grave, the state of physical death. Second, the place or state or realm to which wicked persons pass at physical death. And thirdly, a kind of a figurative or symbolic use, a great depth as contrasted with a great height. You can translate in Psalm 139 that way. If I go up to the heavens, if I go down to the depths. Sha'ol. And most of the cases fall in the first category of meaning. A few seem to fall in the second category. The wicked will turn to Sha'ol, even all the nations who forget God, for example. Proverbs 23, 13 and 14. So there are a couple of uses like that, and some that are considered problematic, but they fall into the first sense of death rather simply. Page 196, the Greek word Hades, used 10 times in the New Testament. The Authorized Version translates it all 10 times as hell. That's a little confusing, because, see, if you say hell for the intermediate state and hell for the final state, then there's no distinction discernible. And that's probably why that was such a new idea to me. because I used the Authorized Version so long and didn't realize there was any distinction between the two states. I've given all 10 of the uses. Matthew 11, Matthew 16, which is a very interesting reference, Acts chapter 2, which is a very important reference, and there the translation is rather important. Does anybody have the NIV? Brian, how does the NIV translate Acts 2, verse 27 and verse 31? Acts 2, 27 and Acts 2, 31.
27, because you will not abandon me to the grave, nor will you let your Holy One see decay. And 31 says, seeing what was ahead, he spoke of the resurrection of the Christ, and he was not abandoned to the grave, nor did his body see decay.
See, that's essentially the same as the NASB. The Authorized Version really gives a different impression. You will not leave my soul in hell. That idea is quite different from abandoned to. And the two seem to be parallel in the NASB and NIV. You will not abandon my soul to Hades. You will not allow your Holy One to suffer or undergo decay. And I suggest the implications of that on page 197. Revelation 1:18, I have the keys, Christ says, of death and of Hades. Revelation 6:8, Revelation 20, which is rather important, 20:13 and 14. It's a little obscure when you first look at it. Death and Hades gave up the dead which were in them. And death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. And my suggestion here is that the combination of the sea and death and Hades delivering up the dead would appear to be a reference to the reuniting of bodies and disembodied spirits at the resurrection. Out of the sea and out of the graves on land, the bodies of the wicked dead are reconstituted, made alive. Out of Hades come the disembodied soul spirits of the wicked dead. And then they're reunited, judged, and cast, now re-embodied, into the lake of fire. Luke 16, very crucial. And we need to spend a little time there. Luke 16, 19 through 31. You know the passage, it's very familiar. It uses the word Hades. Let's go through the analysis. First, what is the genre? What is the literary form of this discourse? Is it fiction? If fiction, is it a parable, an allegory, or an illustrative story? Or is it nonfiction? Is it fiction or nonfiction? So first you have to decide that category and then the specific genre. It appears to have some characteristic elements of parabolic teaching. The characters could be representative and truth is clearly illustrated. And yet if it is parabolic, it's the only one in which a character is given a proper name. However, if the proper name were a name used frequently, as in such teaching, then it could still be fiction. And it still could be one of these other allegory, parable, illustrative story, no problem. So it has both elements, parabolic and non-fictional elements. Second, what's the truth value of the discourse for knowledge concerning intermediate state? This is very important. Very little is revealed elsewhere about the nature of the intermediate state. Many details are provided here about human experience after physical death. So we would have to ask this question if Jesus would knowingly have misled his readers about the intermediate state if he knew that what he was saying was not true. In other words, if it were a fictional story but did not have verisimilitude, if it did not have true elements in it, didn't represent the intermediate state true, even though a fictional story about the intermediate state. So the important question is not what is the genre. See, because everybody says, oh, that's just a parable. But that doesn't settle anything. I mean, that's just the beginning. That's not the end. They want to make it the end of the discussion. But that's just the beginning. You just start opening it up there. I don't know how many people I've run across who have said that. That's just a parable. As if you can't learn anything. Why did Jesus teach in parables? For fun? I mean, what's the point of all of that nonsense? Parabolic teaching conveys truth. The question is, what is being taught by the parable? That's always the question you have to raise. If somebody says, oh, that's just a parable, what does it teach? They never thought of that question. It never occurred to them under the sky. Well, anyway. The question then is, what is being taught here? What is being communicated? Whether it's by a parable or an allegory or an illustrative story, what is being taught here? Lots of information is given here. Question is it erroneous? Is Jesus telling us some things about the intermediate state that are not true, that don't really represent that state? If so, I would think it'd be a terrible misleading of us about this, since there's so little information in all of Jesus' teaching about the intermediate state. So I think you have to face that question, however you answer it. You have to face it. Thirdly, the character of the two men. You say, well, it doesn't say much about the character of the two men. Well, now, the one man was rich, apparently a Jew. He had Moses and the prophets. He had Moses and the prophets. Internal evidence in the account itself. But he didn't listen to Moses and the prophets as far as repentance of sin and obedience and righteousness. He wasn't a righteous man. How do we know that? He went to Hades. The other man, Lazarus, he was poor. He was apparently a cripple. He was covered with sores. He was reduced to beggary. Now, someone may say, wait a minute. How can you have a Jew who's reduced to beggary? How can you possibly have a Jew reduced to beggary? How could he be a righteous man? If he were a Jew, how could he be a righteous man? I mean, immediately there pop into your minds certain scriptures. As, for instance, I've never seen the righteous forsaking nor his seed begging bread. Here's a man begging bread. He couldn't have been righteous, right? Well, I'm suggesting that he was apparently a Jew, lived there in that area, and a righteous man. How do we know he was righteous? He went to heaven. But how could he be righteous and be begging bread? See, that's the question. Anybody have any suggestions? Ray.
I was thinking that you could have a righteous Jew who was a beggar simply because those Jews who had things did not obey the commandments to give to the poor.
Were there Jews like that in Israel who didn't obey the commandments to give to the poor?
Sure, there's an example where
where
leaders told their children to give to the temple and forget their parents.
Ah.
So of course there were. So this righteous man was probably a good test for this wicked man to see whether or not he was be obedient to God and fail.
Right at his door. Yes. What is the nature of physical death? Lazarus is carried by the angels to Abraham's side or bosom. His body was probably buried in a pauper's grave or burned in the valley of Hinnom with the trash. The rich man died. His body was buried, probably in a richly ornamented tomb hewn out of stone. That seemed to be the place for rich people to be buried, very ornamental places. And his soul spirit went into Hades. Again, from the passage, internal evidence. Both men became disembodied in the experience of physical death. Now, if you don't keep that in mind, you miss a lot of the teaching of the account. You've got to keep reminding yourself they were both disembodied following physical death. In their disembodied state, they're both conscious of their condition, they're conscious of their surroundings, they could feel, they could think, they could speak. And yet they're disembodied. Fifthly, what's the nature of the two places or states or realms into which the two men went? Lazarus went to heaven, where Abraham was. He was carried there by angels and comforted. Does that mean that all righteous people who die are carried by angels to heaven? That's an interesting thought. I don't know the answer to that. Maybe you know. I don't know. It'd be fascinating. The rich man went to Hades, and in Hades he was in torment, he was in agony in this flame, he was in agony, he was in a place of torment. Clearly, internal evidence again. Sixthly, since these two men were in a disembodied state, how are we to interpret the physical terms used in the account? And a lot of people really stumble over these physical terms. The rich man had no physical body. You've got to keep thinking he was disembodied. He didn't have any physical body. But he lifted up his eyes. He was in torment. He saw. He cried out. He wanted Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water. But Lazarus was disembodied too. And cool off his tongue, the rich man's tongue. He was in agony in the flame. And yet these are not physical eyes or finger or tongue or flame. Again, you have to keep reminding yourself he was disembodied. He doesn't have any more physical eyes, finger, tongue, or flame in his disembodied state. They're in the grave. They're decomposing. And I suggest here an analogy from anthropomorphism as applied to God. Once you get hold of what anthropomorphism is really all about, which is not an easy concept. But if you can think of God being spoken of in terms of human organs and human functions, and then think of God doing those functions that human beings perform through those physical organs, and then strip away the physical organs from God, who is incorporeal, and yet leave the functions remaining, so that God sees and God knows and God hears and God... All of those, of course, mean he knows, simply. He knows. He has knowledge. The things that we talk about with our senses, we gain information through our senses. So God knows. And God's eyes, see, that's a function, again, looking. God knowing. And I suggest that this may be speaking of functions that disembodied persons perform in the spirit world. How? By terms appropriate to the physical world. How else do you think that these functions would be described? That is, unless they're described in familiar terms. It'd be kind of interesting to speculate on that. What kind of terms would you employ if you were trying to express that? Another possible explanation of these physical terms is this idea that those who have recently experienced physical death may persist for a time in thinking in and using physical terms to express non-physical functions in their disembodied existence. I remember an old film I saw once on television in which a soldier had his leg amputated, and he didn't know the leg was amputated. And he kept saying, "I feel such pain in my left foot. It hurts so much." And the fellow next to him started to say, "But you..." And they stopped him quickly because his left leg had been amputated. And he kept feeling pain in his left foot. Finally, somebody let the cat out of the bag, and he sat up quickly. He says, "My leg, it's gone." But he felt the pain in his left foot. It's kind of interesting. The idea of feeling something that really isn't there anymore, to feel that. Of course, you can say, well, he was feeling it in his brain, not in his foot, you know. It may be that people talk about and think about functions in this disembodied state in terms of these physical organs that they've been so accustomed to thinking about and talking about in this present existence. And that may persist for a while. That's another way of interpreting these physical terms. Seventhly, how do we know that these are intermediate and not final states? Well, the problem there is, if we're in the final states, if we're past the final judgment, then there's no more opportunity for the unrighteous to repent. But here's the rich man begging Abraham to send Lazarus to his father's house to try to persuade his five living brothers to repent and to avoid Hades. But that's not a possibility once you get past the final judgment, once the eternal states are entered, once everything is complete and settled. So this has got to be talking about the intermediate state and not the final state. See, that would have been a very neat solution to the physical terms. Say, well, what do you mean? It's talking about re-embodiment, where the soul spirit is once again united to the body. And so physical terms are very meaningful in the re-embodied state. But this isn't talking about the re-embodied state, the eternal state. It's talking about the intermediate state, the disembodied state. So you've got to explain it some other way. And eighthly, is human destiny fixed at the final judgment or at death? Which? Well, there's a great chasm, the passage says, between heaven and Hades. Those who may wish to cross over are not able to do so. The rich man suggests that human beings who have passed from earth to heaven may be able to return to earth, but there's no record of anyone ever having done this. Appearance of Moses and Elijah in a vision is not the same as coming from heaven to earth. Ray.
What about the Lazarus? He'd been dead 3 days, so apparently his body and his soul were separated.
Yes. We don't really know what the situation is concerning Lazarus during that time. The temptation is to think that Lazarus was in heaven during that time and that he then returned to earth, I'm using physical, spatial terms here, and was re-embodied. The problem is whether Lazarus was dead in this sense of an irreversible loss of vital functions. That's the problem. In other words, had rigor mortis set in? No, it doesn't say that. She said that.
Yeah.
She said,